Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rehabilitating Your Portfolio, a podcast about how to protect capital while still capturing the upside. And now, here's your host, Brett Rosenthal.
Welcome to the show. I'm your host, Brett Rosenthal, and we are going to explore all aspects of rehabilitating your investment portfolio. Don't forget, this is a live trading desk we're broadcasting from. So we're actively managing assets here, both our own private capital, family capital, and that of individuals. And so while we're doing this show, the phones may ring, or I might have to put you on, you know, pause for a second to execute some orders. But until that happens, I'm going to try to, as always, share with you tools that we're actually using today, right now, to manage capital and manage it in a way to, you know, if your portfolio is struggling, it'll help rehabilitate that portfolio and allow you to start growing your assets again. And, you know, if you're having success, then using these algorithmic tools that we use to direct your capital investments based on reward versus risk probabilities will enhance your performance. You'll have, you'll suffer less when the markets collapse, and you'll be able to still capture upside. That's what we do here. So, first step is always on these on the show is to go into a look of our algorithmic strategies on the big indexes. We start with the pyramid of investing for us. At the top is the S&P, the small cap index, and the NASDAQ 100 using ETFs, so the SPY, the QQQ, the IWMs, and treasuries, 30-year, 20-plus year treasuries using TLT as the symbol. That's the top of our pyramid. We first find out what are the markets doing there, and then we start drilling down into groups and into individual stocks. So when last I left you, we had a pretty vicious sell-off going on. We talked about how we were stopped out of our long entry from the beginning or middle of July. We were back into cash. The market was the S&P was trading below the 50-day moving average, and the small cap index was down at 200-day moving average, actually flat on the year. So the performance of the small cap index is flat on the year. So while there's all this hype and excitement about Dow, you know, reaching new levels and you know, the NASDAQ 100, the S&P, but really we've discovered and we've talked ad nauseum on this show about how there's really 10 stocks that are leading the entire market. There's like actually six stocks that equal the performance of the six stocks, which are the Facebook, the FANG stocks, right? Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, and Google, plus Microsoft, account for almost 50% of the S&P 500's move for the year. And you couple that with the fact that the Russell 2000 index is flat to down on the year, and you realize that the year's not as rosy as it may appear on CNBC or in the Wall Street Journal. There's definitely risk out there, and knowing where to put capital and when is key in a year like this. It's a grinding year. It's a confusing year, and this most recent week is no different. We had a bunch of saber-rattling discussions with North Korea, so the market went from the highs of the year right down to the 50-day moving average in 3 days, or the 200-day for the small cap index. Now, of course, we've had the inevitable bounce, and if you've been following me on Twitter, which I would suggest if you want to stay a little more current with information about how we're managing capital at the moment, what I discuss on our Twitter feed, and which is at Brett Rosenthal, B-R-E-T, which is one T, Rosenthal, R-O-S-E-N-T-H-A-L, what I discuss is number one, completely typical for the market to gap up yesterday after a hard sell-off like that. Just normal, especially if you're in a big uptrend, which, you know, the market averages are in an uptrend. So to get the S&P and the NASDAQ 100 to gap up is no surprise. What is, you know, maybe concerning for those bulls out there is that the volume yesterday was very light. So what you want to see for a real reversal and turnaround is a higher volume spike. But it doesn't always have to happen that way, and that's not a key part of our algorithms. And this is something that's, you know, you might find interesting if you've been doing this for a long time, if you've been investing for a long time, if you are a student of the markets. Volume is always very important, you're told, over and over again. And I submit to you that we live in a different world today. The post-2008 apocalyptic world, where central banks control liquidity and liquidity flows control the market and algorithms control trading behavior. That's the world we live in now. Stop fighting it. Learn to live with it. This is not a market of PE valuations and trying to determine what stocks are worth based on economic cycles. This is a market where you have to determine direction based on central bank liquidity or reduction in liquidity, addition or reduction in liquidity, and at the same time, algorithmic trading vehicles that dominate the day-to-day volatility of the market. And it's those vehicles that I'm talking about now when it comes to volume, where typically we would think that volume is the most important, one of the most important issues about markets that go up or down. So markets up yesterday, there's no volume. Traditional analysis would tell us that's negative for the market. It's not always like that today, though. So I used to put a lot of faith in that theory, and yet I put less faith in the theory today. If the algorithms give us buy signals today, we'll be putting money to work in the market, and the volume could hit tomorrow. Algorithms and algorithmic investing care less about the volume figures and more about price points and pushing on people's pain points. And fear and greed. That's what kind of drives the market. So while volume might be important to build a multi-month uptrend, we're living with the day-to-day volatility of the market. And I've seen time and again days that look like, wow, that was, you know, a lot of movement with no volume. And then the next day, the volume comes in, or 2 days later, the volume comes in. And generally speaking, I believe that that's because algorithms are sniffing out direction and are putting capital to work before you get the major move from big institutions. So, you know, take it for what it's worth. I'm just saying there are certain rules that used to be gospel before 2008 that aren't gospel anymore. But I guess I've digressed too far. Let's get back to our algorithmic strategies. Right now, we're in cash on the big indexes, okay? Yesterday's action did not get us long. Yesterday's action's normal. We would have to see some type of follow-through on the upside in a manner that our algorithms find appropriate that would get us long. We're not always long, by the way. The market could make new highs in the next week, and I might still be in cash. That's okay. We go through periods like that in the market. But what we've found over 10, 15 years of back testing and optimizing our algorithms is that the market will always come to us if we're patient. If we're patient, we'll be buying weakness and we'll be selling into strength. That's how you make money in the market. That's how you increase your net worth. That's how you protect your capital. It's buying the weakness and selling into strength. And you've heard that over and over again over your life as an investor. And it seems very easy, and yet it's impossible to replicate. Like, how do you know when to buy the weakness? Because right after that, you know, wonderful saying or idiom or whatever you want to call that you know, rule of buying weakness and selling into strength, comes the very next rule someone will say to you is, well, don't catch a falling knife. wait a minute, if I'm supposed to buy weakness, but I'm not supposed to catch a falling knife, then how do I ever put money to work? Right? That's kind of really frustrating and you know, counterproductive to hear those two things. Well, what I would submit to you is that algorithmic investing is what we use to buy our weakness. Okay, I had to step away there for that call, but I'm back, and we were talking about buying weakness and dealing with that frustration of hearing about buying weakness and then having people say, well, don't catch a falling knife. What we do with algorithms is they help us buy the weakness, because what we're really doing is we're gearing our strategies towards the best reward versus risk setups on a probability and statistical basis. And what you end up doing, what you discover you end up doing the majority of the time is buying weakness. Now, it doesn't mean we're buying a big down day. What we're looking to do is after X amount of days of selling or weakness or consolidation, we're then buying. Now, it could be the day we're buying is an up day. So, but there's the rub. You don't have to buy the collapse. You can wait for the collapse to wash itself out and then start putting capital to work. And it very often it's on an up day. But it generally is that up day where most people are frozen. They don't know what to do because the market's been down significantly over a period of time. And then there's this up day and they sit around saying, they're scratching their heads, what do I do now? Well, what we're doing now is executing and putting money to work because the algorithms say it's time to do that. We don't have that signal yet. Just because the market was up yesterday does not mean we're putting money to work yet. So we're still cash on the S&P, the NASDAQ, and the small caps. And on the Treasury trade, now, I mean, we had a long entry that we discussed with everybody on the 9th of August. So that's a few days ago. The very next day, we booked half of our profit on that position, and today we're challenging our stop, which is a raised stop. So when we had that entry, I let you all know that was not a high probability entry. It's something that you could trade if you want, but for investors, we're not putting money in long-term treasuries at the moment. But so that's where those four indexes stand. And then if we drill down into the groups, you know, we follow 26 different ETFs, you know, groups. And we use the ETFs to do it. Of those 26, up until yesterday, only 6 were long the market and 20 were in cash. So a couple have, you know, made their way back over to the plus column, but none of which I want to discuss with you or share today. I really have more interest in adding groups once we're long the indexes themselves. So on a day where the S&P tells us it's time to get long, then we drill down and look into which groups do we want to start putting to work. Sometimes we buy groups early, but that's generally after a big sell-off in the market, not after a three-day sell-off. So if the markets have a 2 or 3 month decline and we're scraping down at the bottom of the barrel and then all of a sudden we get some groups that pop out, we might put some money in the groups first. But generally we start at the top of that investing pyramid. You know, 3 out of 4 stocks follow the market. I say that almost every day on this show, and I'm going to keep saying it until you really commit it to memory and understand it. When you're investing, when it's time to put money to work, it's not about dollar cost averaging. It's not about, oh, I'll buy a little bit today because I had a Starbucks and that coffee was pretty good. Let's buy shares of Starbucks. That's not how you invest. 3 out of 4 stocks follow the market. You need to understand the direction of the market. Once you get that direction down, then you can start putting your individual stocks to work. So at the moment, from a index-only portfolio that's only long the big indexes, we're cash. I'm not adding any groups right now to those types of algorithm portfolios. And, of course, we don't own any stocks at the moment in that algorithm portfolio. Now, the way you can use this information in your portfolio, it doesn't mean you have to be 100% cash today. I'm not recommending what you do with your capital. I don't know you. I don't know what your portfolio looks like. So that would be wrong for me to do. But what I am saying is how we use it in our client structure. whether it be my personal capital or that of individuals we work with, based on each person's risk tolerance and investment goals, you might have, let's say, 30% of your capital committed long-term that you're not going to sell. You want to own shares of Apple, and you think it's only going to go up the rest of your lifetime. Okay, I mean, I'm not going to convince you otherwise. But instead of having 50 or 100% of your money there, you might hold on to your, let's say you want 30% invested in individual names that you never want to sell. Okay, fine, leave your 30 alone. But when do you increase to 100% or decrease down to your hard deck of 30%? Using algorithms can help you do that. And so when the algorithms all say, hey, you got to get out of Dodge right now, you can do some things to pare back a portfolio and manage your risk. So when we go through the inevitable market sell-off like 2008, it will happen again. Will it be as big as 08? Who knows? But there is another big sell-off coming. We're not going to have a market that goes up only in one direction, only higher, never selling off more than 3%. It's not going to be like that the rest of our lives. At some point, central banks will reduce liquidity. And when that happens, if you haven't built the correct disciplines for managing risk, then all of the paper profits that you might be looking at in your portfolio now are going to evaporate. And that doesn't help anybody when it comes time to retire. You've got to have the right disciplines to manage your risk. And it's best to work on those disciplines when the market's going up. Right? Everyone's happy, market's going higher. That's when you work on your disciplines to manage your risk and protect your capital. And I'm just going to leave you then with some thoughts today on the news cycle, and I just want to keep clarifying. We talked about North Korea. Is it any surprise the market was up yesterday? North Korea's, you know, come out and said they're not going to try to bomb Guam. You know, that's great. But the grand scheme of things, and I think what's, if we want to try to interpret the news, so there's two different parts of this radio show today, right? The first is algorithmic investing, it's risk management, it's not caring what the news cycle is and just focusing on reward versus risk probabilities. At the moment, the risk is too high, and based on our algorithms, the reward is not worth it. So we're in cash. That's not a prediction that the market has to go down. Algorithms don't predict. They just tell us, and I should say some algorithms predict. Our algorithms don't, right? Probability and statistical algorithms just tell you the risk is too high and the potential reward from these levels not great enough. Fine, then I'd rather carry cash. When that equation changes, I'll put money to work. Now, if we want to have some fun and try to understand news cycles, then what I've been tweeting about, and you can also follow us on Twitter if you wish, you can go to our website, which is rosenthalcapital.com, and if you scroll down to the bottom of our homepage, you'll see our Twitter feed, so you can also follow us on our homepage, you can see our Twitter feed. And what we've been talking about is that you, in order to understand how news will affect markets over the next couple of weeks and months, it's not necessarily news of war or not war or crazy Koreans or not crazy North Koreans. It's a question of how the news is viewed by central bankers. So this is the thought I'll leave you with today. Central bankers determine the direction of markets right now, not economic cycles, not earnings announcements with P.E. ratios attached to them. That may affect day-to-day volatility, but overall direction over a 3, 6, 12-month period is determined by liquidity being added or reduced from the system by central banks. So when you get a news story, you have to ask yourself, how does the central banker see it? And will that change the market's perception of what liquidity will be in the next month to 3 months to 6 months? So when we first had those North Korean stories, yes, the knee-jerk reaction is to sell the market off, but I would submit to you that the market would actually move higher at a faster rate if there actually was conflict. Because if there is some type of conflict, then the Fed cannot reduce liquidity, which the Fed is expected to do in September. If the geopolitical noise is loud enough between now and the next Fed meeting, and it forces the Fed to not reduce the balance sheet, then the market goes higher. I don't care what's happening around the world. That will put the market higher, along with the fact that central bankers, other Western central bankers, continue to add liquidity. But if we get stories like, hey, there is no geopolitical tension, let's say we get a resolution and all of a sudden North Korea agrees to stop working on their nuclear facilities some magical way, the market will be up that day. I'm not saying it won't be up for that day, but longer term, that'll have negative impact on the market because now the Fed can say, great, geopolitical risks are down. Oh, and by the way, there was economic news today that suggested there was some strong data that would mean that GDP is growing faster than expected and perhaps inflation. That came out this morning. So those things will have a negative impact. And what will happen come September is the Fed might take action that's more aggressive when it comes to reducing liquidity. And that's bad for the market. Okay, so seemingly good news. While it might spike the market on a one-day basis, over the next week to 3 weeks to a month to 2 months, if that positive news piles up, it's negative for the market. Never forget that. Central bank liquidity is driving the market. We have a market right now. This is my favorite statistic. You've heard it before. European junk bond debt as a whole is trading with a yield lower than U.S. 30-year treasuries. If you're still using valuation to understand that model, then your head's going to explode. It will never make sense. You could be writing and doing calculus all day long trying to figure out how is it possible that junk bonds in Europe of private corporations that have junk status that may go bankrupt shortly are yielding lower than 30-year U.S. treasuries, suggesting they're safer investments than 30-year U.S. treasuries. The only way that's possible is because, as the European Central Bank has told us and they show us, they are printing euros and buying European junk debt. So you have a buyer of unlimited resources buying a finite amount. This is just a supply and demand issue. When the Central Bank of Europe begins to wind down that strategy, equity markets are going to go lower. And so what you need to do is watch news stories and try to gauge, is this going to be driving central bankers to reduce liquidity or allow them to continue to increase it? And that's the way to understand financial news today. So hope you've enjoyed this conversation. I look forward to having it again tomorrow. And have a successful day of trading and a successful day of investing. And we look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Take care.
To learn more about how to protect capital and still capture the upside, join us at rosenthalcapital.com. And for real-time updates about what our algorithms are saying, follow us on Twitter at Brett Rosenthal, B-R-E-T-R-O-S-E-N-T-H-A-L.